Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope you had a great weekend. Thanks for joining us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, Guarding the Red, Riverkeepers, the Power of Community Stewardship. Prairie Public's CEO John Harris sits down with Riverkeepers Executive Director Christine Holland, and she shares how a small nonprofit with just two staff and more than 1,500 volunteers has helped transform the Red River into a cleaner, safer, and more accessible resource. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and April is World Wish Month, marking the founding of Make-A-Wish, and it's an organization built on a simple but powerful idea that a wish can bring hope, strength, and joy to children and families facing critical illnesses. Here in North Dakota, that mission has touched hundreds of families with wishes ranging from travel and experiences to meaningful acts of giving back. In fact, some children even choose to use their wish to help others in our communities, a reflection of just how powerful this experience can be. Joining us again is Billie Jo Zielinski. She's the president and CEO of Make-A-Wish North Dakota. Billie, thanks for what you do, and welcome back to Main Street.
I thank you very much. It's a privilege. So thank you for amplifying our mission in this way. Appreciate you.
So happy to do that. So happy to meet the founder of Make-A-Wish last year about this time, Linda. Tell me how she's doing and reminisce about her son, Chris.
Yeah, so Make-A-Wish was not just a moment. You talk about the experience, right? So there was a little boy named Chris Gracious, a 7-year-old who had leukemia, and his one wish was to be a police officer. And his mom, Linda Pauling, had known this Border Patrol agent, and she said, you know what? If you could ever, you know, make his wish come true, that would be the world to him. And time had gone on, and about a little bit later, about a month later, on April 29th, they made his wish come true. And it wasn't just this, again, ride in a patrol car. It was a ride in the helicopter. It was a tour of the Department of Public Safety. He became an honorary, you know, highway patrolman. I mean, he had a full officer, and everybody called him the bubblegum trooper. He was just, it was a wonderful day of joy in a pretty dark time. So yeah. Shortly thereafter, he did pass away, and the volunteers who made that happen, including Linda, had said, you know, answered a question about what if we could do this for many children who have critical illnesses. And Linda, to this day, you got to meet her. She is full of this mission, embodies what it means to give children joy. And she's still involved in our mission all these years later, 46 years later. And I just think that's pretty remarkable.
It's so remarkable. And it was so inspirational for me to meet her, this woman who had this tragedy, this tragic loss of her son, yet still to this day contributes so much. And she's not a just kind of a poster person for the organization.
No.
She digs in and she works so hard and travels across the country and has done so much good for so many out of her own tragedy. What does this time mean to your organization here?
Yeah.
Billie Jo, in North Dakota, and the families that you serve.
Yeah, so World Wish Month is really, highlights everything that we do year-round and really gives us an opportunity across the United States, because there are 57 chapters, and actually around the world, there are about 50 other affiliates who are making wishes come true to children abroad. It aligns us all, though, around our one mission. Together, we create life-changing wishes for children with critical illnesses, and we want to make sure that we are realizing our vision to reach every eligible child. And this month in particular, we celebrate not only the wishes themselves, we have a lot of wishes that are happening here in North Dakota, but also our volunteers across the state. We cannot do what we do with our small and mighty team. We have to depend on these individuals who dedicate their time and energy to discovering the wishes, raising money, etc. So we have about 200 volunteers across the state of North Dakota who are helping. We also can't start the journey without referral sources. So there are some dedicated doctors and nurses, child life specialists, pediatricians, social workers who are the ones who actually see the child and refer them to our program. And so we are celebrating everyone. Everyone can become a wish maker. So really, it's a call to action of how can I help this month, highlighting what we do and how you can be involved.
What do wishes in North Dakota look like in practice?
In practice, they are really a journey. And I do want to say they are curated experiences. It is beyond a moment, for sure. It is that start when the family is diagnosed. When you are diagnosed with a condition, your whole life is turned upside down. The child gets told no a lot. You cannot go to school now. We have to go down to Mayo to treat our condition. Or you can't play sports anymore because your bones are weak, or whatever the no may be. And what happens after the diagnosis and that life-changing experience, we have another life-changing experience that comes along with these volunteers who say, what are some of your favorites? What gives you joy? Who might be along this experience with you? And they're the ones who actually discover what that wish could look like. And then in practice, we, as a small and mighty team, work behind the scenes. And a lot of our wishes involve travel. And so we are the ones who are making all the logistics happen. And so it's either a wish to go somewhere, or I wish to meet someone, which often involves travel as well, or I wish to be something like either Santa Claus or
a highway patrol trooper.
Highway patrol trooper, or even a beekeeper we've had in North Dakota. Or I wish to have something. You know, lately it's been YouTube setups, or, you know, a puppy, or whatever that may bring the child the most joy. And so what it looks like is that we've granted almost 1,200 wishes since our inception in 1985. And it means that, unfortunately, 67 children every year are diagnosed with a condition that could qualify for Make-A-Wish. And we are determined to make sure that we are reaching everyone.
That everyone line leads to my next question, because there are some folks who think, well, you know, I have the means, I'll just take care of this for my loved one by myself. But in fact, Make-A-Wish can really help families regardless of personal demographics.
Absolutely. Our criteria for eligibility are really simple. You need to be a child who's between the ages of 2.5 and 18 at referral. You have to have a condition that is not necessarily terminal, but may put the child's life in jeopardy, degenerative, malignant, etc., and then not had another wish from a wish-granting organization. But nowhere in that did I say anything about economics. You know, illness doesn't know if you're rich or poor. We don't care either. And I know some families who say, no, when they hear Make-A-Wish, it seems charitable, like a charitable handout or so on and so forth. But I hope they can say, this gives your child the empowerment to say yes. Because again, we hear that no so much, and it gives them the strength to say, it's what I would like to do. Even you can't create the experiences that Make-A-Wish can create, especially, like, let's just give an example of Disney World. When you go to Disney World, when you are a Make-A-Wish child, you stay at a village, and it's a magical village called Give Kids the World. It's a magical place unto itself, where the mayor is actually a bunny, and you stay in these villas, and all the kids and families are going through the same things you are. And you get to have ice cream for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But then you also get these the rides to the park, and then when you're wearing your Make-A-Wish shirt, you go right to the front of the line. And those types of experiences you cannot replicate. You can't meet your favorite basketball player. You can't go and meet John Cena. You know, those are types of things that we can create. The other thing is, you know, it is a privilege to be allowed into families' life at such vulnerable times, but to realize there are so many other individuals who just want to help and they don't know how. And if they could just give through an organization like ours to help kids and families who are going through this, because it's draining, and they just want to make sure that they're lifting others up.
Enjoying my conversation with Billy Joe Zielinski, the president and CEO of Make-A-Wish North Dakota. We talked about this a little bit last year, but give me the perspective of the healthcare provider who then gets to see their patient, their concern, experience Make-A-Wish.
You know, that is something I just saw at our Wine and Wishes Gala last month. We had Dr. Wyatt from Sanford, who has been treating a little boy, Everett, who has PCAN, which is iron deposits on the brain, and it's degenerative. And he was on a panel with Everett and his parents and the wish granter, and he explained the journey and explained the diagnosis. But then the whole community of attendees at Wine and Wishes got to experience that his wish was revealed to go and see giraffes at the San Diego Zoo. In fact, we had worked with our sister chapter in San Diego, and they had a zookeeper give us a video in front of all these giraffes and said, Everett, your wish is going to be coming true. The elation, the tears of joy that Dr. Wyatt saw in that family, it inspired him to call us that very Monday afterwards and say, I think I have more kids that I may have missed. Let's look at these diagnoses again. When you see the power and the impact that it has on these families, and they didn't even, you know, they weren't going at, you know, that day, but he could see that it had something hopeful to look for. And it gives them something else to talk about, right? What are you going to be seeing on your wish? How did it really impact you? And physicians have told us, what families have told us for years, we did a study on this, that it helps with treatment protocols. Our families and kiddos are more willing, saying, I got to get stronger. I'm going to go fishing in Alaska, you know, or it is also mental health. I mean, when you are also told no, it can be very isolating. There can be some real mental health issues and struggles. And this gives them something to, again, combat that and make sure that they are feeling more confident and more self-assured. So it is something that the medical field is not necessarily, we like to call wishes our medicine. We don't necessarily are taking, it's a part of the medical journey.
I mentioned in my opening wishes that give back to others, which gives me goosebumps. Young people who have that willingness to give in their greatest time of need. Tell me some of those stories.
Well, the one that I don't have favorites because every child is my favorite. But I will have to say Santa Keaton, back in 2017, he had cystic fibrosis and he had been hospitalized many times during the holiday season. And when he was asked if he could have one wish or what does it look like? He really thought about, I want to be Santa Claus, and I want to deliver candy and gifts to kids when they're in the hospital. And we could have just done that. We could have just taken him to the hospital and had him do that. But he was bigger than life, and he loved Christmas. He had trees in his bedroom. He had big nutcrackers. He loved Christmas. And so we partnered with Macy's. They created a winter wonderland. They made him a little Santa suit. His class came with all these little elf hats. And then we had him on a horse-drawn carriage all the way down Broadway, and the streets were lined with individuals waving signs saying, Happy Wish Day, Keaton. And when he got to the hospital, it was so sweet in that he didn't just give the gifts, but the one precious moment I remember is a kiddo he read a book to, and he sat and took that time to read a book to a kiddo who was in the hospital. This is a 7-year-old boy. It's just remarkable. I think he was 9, but still young enough to, you know, just amazing.
To have such a giving heart.
I know. Sure. And unfortunately, he's no longer with us. And I think that I like to make sure that we keep that story alive for the families and all those people who remember it, remember the impact. Because I'll say this, I feel like that it didn't just impact him and his family. I feel like every person along that parade route felt like, gosh, isn't that remarkable? Well, I could see how it even affects you, Craig.
Gosh, yeah. It's always an emotional chat with you for the great work that you do, Billy Joe. You talked about how volunteers are essential to Make-A-Wish here in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. Expand on that a little bit more and let people know what their doorway is to help you.
Absolutely. So our volunteers are, you know, really the first line of experience with Make-A-Wish. We can't always get to Belcourt or Dunseith or, you know, out in outstate North Dakota. We're based in Fargo. We have a couple of people, one in Berlin and one in Bismarck, but we have to depend on these volunteers who are usually in teams of two. They are specially trained, those wish-granting volunteers in particular, they're specially trained to not only be able to talk with complete strangers and wrap around them with compassion and empathy, but also if our child is nonverbal, making sure that they're trained to understand how they can get to the heart of the wish as well with that. And so those volunteers who really have a calling to do wish granting, that is something that is as simple as filling out an application, having an interview with us, a little bit more involved, I guess, because you do have to do a little bit more training. But then you are able to see the true impact of wish, and you actually follow the child and the family throughout the journey. So once you discover it, then you can actually reveal it in your community and whatever that looks like to that family. So some families don't want what Keaton wanted, right? They want something that is just for them, and that is perfectly fine. No publicity, just a quiet wish reveal, and they can create that wish reveal, and sometimes they are lasting friends even beyond the wish, and helping them be part of their support network. We also have event volunteers, so we do two things for the most part. We grant wishes, and we raise money to be able to grant those wishes, and that's another thing we cannot do alone. And so volunteers help through events, through different functions of peer-to-peer fundraisers, whatever it may be. We also can accept unused airline miles, and our volunteers also donate unused airline miles from Delta, United, and those help defray the costs. So those volunteers can also be spokespeople for our organization in their communities, you know, talking to people like you or being able to talk to their local service club or to their school about Make-A-Wish and what it means to children and families right here.
You talked about the YouTube experience for one of the persons who was granted a wish. How have those experiences changed in your tenure or over time here in the state? Because things that are happening today didn't exist maybe 5-10 years ago.
Exactly. I have to say, since I started about a dozen years ago, the internet has, I guess it's a help, and maybe, I don't know, it's a help. I mean, there are a lot of kids who can, you know, now you can just ask Copilot, you know, what's the best optimal wish experience? But also we have so much more social media and video of kids on their experiences that they, you know, wherever it may be, that they can get ideas. But really we try to make sure that it can be unique to them. Whatever that is, we still, even though it may look the same, it may have similar characteristics, we really try to make it unique to them in that. So if they, the YouTube experience, we actually brought a local YouTuber to help set the system up. So again, it's not, we try to do the little things too. It's not just the thing. It's the little moments that surround that makes it pretty special. So yes, they have changed dramatically, and you know, we're glad that we can be here to continue to grant them.
What's the first step that a parent or a grandparent maybe, or an aunt or an uncle, a brother or sister should take if they think their loved one, their friend or family member could really benefit from Make-A-Wish?
Absolutely. Well, I think breathe, number one. And then number two, I think obviously surround the family with love. And then when it's appropriate, I think that's the other thing we're very sensitive to. We're never rushing a wish experience. Whenever it is appropriate and the timing would be right to discuss and also experience a Make-A-Wish. Because sometimes it is that reward at the end of a treatment. Sometimes it's, you need that strength through the treatment. So how you do that is you talk with your treating professional, or you can refer right online. As you mentioned, a family member who has enough information about the child or a parent or legal guardian. And then the most of our referrals come from physicians or medical professionals because they have all of the data, the information that would we'd understand their eligibility. But it's really having that conversation. What does this look like? Is my child qualified? And to know that it's a good thing. It's hard. Sometimes we hear Make-A-Wish and we think sad because at the very beginnings when Linda and her team were first starting, it was for terminally ill kids because not only has the internet changed things, medicine has improved greatly over the last 46 years. And so, you know, what was then more of a death wish now has become, you know, something that can be curable, but maybe scary at the time. So people don't understand that Make-A-Wish is actually bringing joy into a family and child's life when they need it most.
Where can people learn more and what events should they keep an eye out for here, either in the short term or throughout the year?
So our website is wish.org/North Dakota, and it lists all the ways that people can become wish makers today. Either that's through a referral, being a volunteer, donating airline miles, donating your treasures in any way that you feel comfortable to be a part of it. I think what we have done this month to highlight World Wish Month, we've partnered with area businesses from a coffee house at the beginning, Froth Coffee House at the beginning of the month, and then across the state, Culver's are selling their stars for $1. We had Deke's Pizza have a promotion last week across the state, and then we have Sandy's Donuts here this coming week where you have a specialized donut. We also did some fun things just with us. We had recognized every week a constituent who is a wishmaker. So we honored and held up our medical professionals. We also had Volunteer Appreciation Week last week, which we also did a fun Spirit Week where we had wear blue, wear your favorite star T-shirt, wear a crazy hat, you know, so on and so forth. And this week we're honoring those donors, and then also the 29th culminates in that World Wish Day where we're actually, the city's being illuminated brave blue. So we have Magnum Electric and the City Hall and RDO and other partners who are turning on their lights to just give more pause and awareness that we are here making wishes come true.
You're wearing a blue star.
Yes.
Why a star?
It's something to, I think, that's a good question, Craig. I hadn't been asked that question. That's a good question. Why the star? I mean, it's always been part of our logo. It's always been part of our magic. Maybe it's the magic. It's also, it's just an identifier. I think it glows in the sky. It gives us hope. It has something to look up to. I'm going to have to think a little bit more deeply about that. You know, one thing that we do, the star is important to us for another reason. As I mentioned, you know, at the very beginning, a lot of the times we were serving kids with terminal illnesses, and when they do pass away, we actually give them the coordinates to a star in the sky, because that way it'll live on for very many years. Mm-hmm. And they can see that and think of their child that's named in their honor. And they get a certificate, and they know that we are thinking of them always. So.
She's Billy Jo Zielinski, President and CEO of Make-A-Wish North Dakota. April is World Wish Month, celebrating the founding of Make-A-Wish and the thousands of children and their families who have been touched by a simple but powerful idea that hope matters. If you'd like to learn more, you can do so at wish.org/North Dakota. Thank you, Billy Jo.
Thank you, Craig.
Still ahead on Main Street, guarding the red, river keepers and the power of community stewardship. That's still ahead on Main Street, right after this news.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we turn to the Red River and the people working to protect it. Host John Harris, in a recent edition of Prairie Pulse, visits with Riverkeepers Executive Director Christine Holland about environmental stewardship, community engagement, and how the river is changing in the Fargo-Moorhead area.
Hello, and welcome to Prairie Pulse. Our guest joining us now is the Executive Director of Riverkeepers, Christine Holland. Christine, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for the invite.
As we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background, maybe.
Sure. I grew up in small town North Dakota, Findlay, Hope, Northwood, and then came to school at Moorhead State, and it was Moorhead State when I went, and took an internship at Riverkeepers and haven't left the community since.
Well, so for those out there that may not know, what is Riverkeepers?
Sure. We're a nonprofit organization that advocates for safe and sustainable use of the Red River. So we provide opportunities for the community to learn about the Red River, help sustain it, and safely enjoy it. So it's kind of a trifold on those pillars of trying to reach everybody in the community.
Well, of course, I think I introduced you as executive director, but so what is your role and how long have you been involved with the organization?
Yeah, I started as a marketing intern in 1993. And then as that internship ended, the administrative assistant quit. So I got to do that while I finished college. And then while I was looking for a full-time job, the project coordinator quit. So then I got moved into that position for 16 years. And now I've been the executive director since 2014.
Okay. Did you actually give me the mission statement? What is the organization's mission?
To advocate for safe and sustainable use of the Red River.
You did say it. Okay. What about the funding and staffing with the organization?
Yes, we have two full-time staff. Our strength is really with our volunteers. And we get about half of our funding from the watershed districts on either side of the river because of our educational outreach to the community. So the Buffalo Red River Watershed District, the Southeast Cass Water Resource District, and then the rest is memberships, grants, sponsorships, and contracts.
Yeah. So what drew you to environmental advocacy, I guess, particularly in the Red River? Or do you have a background in environmental sciences or advocacy at all?
So I have a background in marketing, and when I started, Riverkeepers was doing Riverfront Days downtown at Dyke East, which was a huge, big event where we brought thousands of people, national music acts, and I did a marketing survey for them. We realized as we were bringing people there just for events, they weren't coming back because they were still scared of, you know, the water quality, the current. So that's when we realized we needed to move from just having fun on the banks of the river during events and really helping the community learn about the river and appreciate it.
So how long has it been active in the FM area?
Since 1990.
Yeah. And so, okay, but you know, back in 90, you talked a little bit about it, but here a study found that the Red River was underutilized and underappreciated. What does that mean?
For sure. So historically we used it, I mean, people moved here because of the Red River, right? They used it for drinking, washing clothes. It was a big steamboat. You could almost walk across the river from boat to boat. There were so many boats downtown. And they'd take goods, furs, wheat, all the way up to Winnipeg. And then the railroad came, right? So we didn't really need to use the boats on the river anymore. It was kind of a slow transportation process with all of the meanders. And then with the dams that got put in the river, there was some undertows and there was some deaths. And then since then, all of the dams on the Red River have been retrofitted with a 5% rock slopeway, so they're much safer now. So we had to teach people about that because they've been told to stay away from the river for years, right? If you grew up here, you probably were told to stay away from the river. And it can be a safe place if you respect it, just like any other water body.
But so with the things you just mentioned, how did the community or mistreat the important resource during the Red River during that time?
Yeah, we just started to ignore it. Like we put roads and parking lots next to the river instead of green space where we could go recreate and gather. And it just didn't look nice down there. When we first started doing cleanups along the river, there was washing machines, dryers, cars, carpet. So now mostly what we find are like plastic bags and food and beverage containers. So, just didn't take care of it at all. Mm-hmm.
So, again, how has Riverkeepers really worked to change that image of the Red River and its role in the area over the years?
Yeah, so it's changing people's perceptions takes a long time, a lot longer than I ever imagined. So teaching them, you know, that the Red River is now safer with those dam retrofits, that it really is our primary drinking water source. We want to take care of it for that. We want to take care of it for the fish and the wildlife along the river. And just to be able to use it for physical activity and mental health.
Mm-hmm. Are there works around the Red River that Riverkeepers has contributed to in the community that, that people might utilize even with or without knowing about it?
So a lot of the times what we do is we use our strengths and complement a project. So we work a lot with the cities of Fargo, Moorhead, the park districts. And so if you see a boat ramp in the river, we're probably a part of that project, helping find the funding or put the right projects partners together. Reforest the Red is one of our largest volunteer events. So we've planted with volunteers thousands and thousands of trees along the river, trying to make that green space where houses used to be along the river and they probably cut down the trees so they could see the river better. And we're trying to build that back up into a healthy riparian area again. So a lot of the younger trees you see along the river were planted for Reforest the Red by volunteers.
Can you talk a little bit about why that's important to the river?
Yeah, so trees are, people think about trees for air quality, but there's so many other benefits. It slows down water, so it makes the river's water quality better. It's green space, so if you're outside and you would rather be by trees than in the middle of a street, right? Because it just draws you. It also is less crime because people are out there together enjoying it. It's good for fish and wildlife habitat. So even if a tree falls into the river, it's a great catfish habitat, right? If it's standing up, it's giving you shade. So there's so many benefits of trees along the river that really makes the Red River a healthy place to be.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned boat ramps. How does implementing infrastructure like boat ramps or aquatic invasive species signs help with sustaining the ecosystem of the Red River?
Yeah, so when we need those systems in order to use it, and we want to be able to use it because that makes you take care of it if you're enjoying it. So when we first started, there was not a map of the river. People used to call me and say, oh yeah, I want to canoe to Grand Forks tomorrow. Well, it's 100 miles up there by river. You're not making it tomorrow. So we worked with Minnesota DNR and partners up and down the river and got it designated as a Minnesota State Water Trail. And so because of that, then we created a master plan and are trying to get boat ramps and accesses every 10 miles to make it easier for people to get on and off campgrounds. And just, like I said, if people can use it easily, they'll get out there and enjoy it. And if you're enjoying something, you just instinctively want to take better care of it.
What's the primary demographics that Riverkeepers aims to reach regarding these education issues, I guess?
Yeah, so as a marketing person, we like target markets, right? Mm-hmm. And with Riverkeepers, the whole community is our target market, which makes it a little bit hard. But we want to reach people where their interests lie. So if you're interested in kayaking and you're out there going down the river and you see people planting trees or enjoying the trees, then maybe next time you'll come out to one of our Reforest the Red projects. Or if you're out there planting trees and you see somebody kayaking, then maybe you'll understand that it's safer and you can go out and use it and enjoy it for recreational purposes.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier a couple of things, but what are ways Riverkeepers stays engaged with the community?
Yeah, so we do a lot of community outreach at different community events, like Red River Market, this weekend, or during Earth Week, we'll be at Red River Zoo for Party for the Planet. Because of our Outreach Ambassador program, we're able to go out to about 20 of those events every year. And then we have our own events as well. Race the Red Canoe and Kayak races. I've been talking a lot about trees because it's Earth Week. Cleanup events. So we have about 500 volunteers that help with those events and activities every year. And just trying to get out. We have fishing, youth fishing clinics, all sorts of things for people to get involved with.
You mentioned volunteers. On average, how many volunteers are part of Riverkeepers in a given year, and what's their role there?
Yeah, volunteers are really the heart of our organization. We work with over 1,500 every year that are amazing. So they help plant trees, they pick up garbage along the river, they make t-shirt totes, so we're trying to promote people using cloth bags instead of plastic bags. They help teach at our Red River Water Festival, which hosts about 80 fourth grade classes every year. So the youth fishing clinics, we have paddling and canoe excursions. So they're leading those and teaching people about the river while they're paddling and enjoying it. So plus board members, we have board members, right? So a board of 15. And so there's always some way that people can get involved, even simple as going out water quality monitoring with us. So we go grab samples so that we can tell you that the river is really just looks muddy because of the clay soil we have, and we have science to back that up. We're not just telling you that.
Yeah. Well, if someone's interested in being a volunteer, I guess I'd ask, you know, well, how can they apply? I assume it's just show interest. But is ages, how old do you have to be?
We work with people from 2 to 92, so anybody. So even if you're 2 years old and you want to come out with your family and plant trees and you're out there with a tiny little sandbox shovel, you're still, you know, digging in the dirt and you're getting the experience and feeling connected. So we embrace everybody who wants to help. And we have an application form just to get your interests and see what fits you the most. So, for instance, when we do the storm drain marking program, and if you live in Fargo, we're probably not going to make you go do streets in Moorhead. We want to do something that fits your interests and lifestyle so that you'll want to come back.
Well, back up, you mentioned programs, activities a little bit. But can you talk about more in depth about some of the programs and activities that you do and when you do them?
Yeah, so I'll just, to make it easy, to go down our Learn, Sustain, Enjoy. We have our upcoming Resilient Yard workshop series, which is a make your own compost tumbler workshop, make your own rain barrel workshop, and a make and paint rain barrel workshop. And we do that because, I mean, we could just make a rain barrel and give it to you, but if you come to our workshop and put some sweat equity into it, you'll probably actually connect it, and you'll learn how to take care of it and maintain it and why it's important. Like I said, we also have the Red River Water Festival for 1,400 fourth graders every year. Our enjoy activities are canoe and kayak rentals with river paddling excursions, youth fishing clinics, interpretive walks and snowshoe walks along the river. And then our sustain activities, reforest the red, cleanups, the t-shirt to tote project. And those are all things that you can do just easy. You don't have to have any experience to do them or participate in them.
Yeah. What does it mean to be a good steward to the land, or in this case, the river?
Yeah, so it feels like more and more we're hearing from people who just go out when they're walking along the river and pick up garbage. But we do have our cleanup program. And one thing that's nice if you work through our program is that, you know, we provide the gloves, the bags, the pickers to make it safe. And then also we get to know how much you're actually picking up, so we don't send a volunteer group out there 3 days after somebody else has already been out there. So that's one way, is just making sure that garbage is picked up along the river and helping plant the trees and using cloth bags instead of plastic bags. It's all really easy things that can be done.
You know, how can someone be more responsible when interacting, I guess, with the ecosystems like the Red River, or being more environmentally responsible?
Sure. I think a lot of those things that I just mentioned, and also just sharing stories with family and friends and even places that you work. So when we have business groups come volunteer, they love it because it's getting their employees outdoors. They're working together. They're building a culture and being a part of the community. And so it's making the whole community stronger, right? Getting out there, planting trees and picking up the garbage, working together.
Well, you've mentioned partnerships with businesses or other organizations. Do you work with other cities like Grand Forks, East Grand Forks, Wahpeton?
Yeah, so our primary focus is Fargo-Moorhead, but we realize that the Red River is 550 miles long in the United States and that we live in a watershed. So the cities Wahpeton, City of Grand Forks particular, their Greenway, Drayton, Pembina, all the way up and down the river. Especially in 2000, we did a canoe trip all the way from Breckenridge all the way up to Selkirk in Canada. And that is what proved to the Minnesota legislature that the Red River is important to everybody and all the communities along the river, not just to staff or riverkeepers. So they were, you know, the communities up and down the river are integral to that water trail, and we learn from each other about what we're doing in our communities.
And you mentioned Canada there. Do you communicate with them much at all? Or
there's other international water organizations that work with them more closely, but we go to conferences and connect with them. Some of our volunteers are up in Winnipeg, but
So why should people recognize Earth Day?
Yeah, so we like to think that it's not just a day, but like something that you should always do. But Earth Day is a great time for people to think about their actions and how it affects not just the river, but the whole Earth, right? So it's a good time to get people thinking about it and acting on it.
As you said, probably shouldn't be just a day. What's the impact River Keepers has had on the Red River, its ecosystem? You talked about picking up things. Any idea on how much waste the group picks up every year or so?
Yeah, so with our volunteers, they pick up a couple thousand pounds every year of garbage. One year we picked up 80 tires out of the river. We thought there was maybe six. And the river was low that year, and we found 80. One year, I was sitting along the river thinking, am I really making a difference? And I went down to the river, and there was somebody fishing, somebody kayaking, family having a picnic, somebody rollerblading and running. And I was like, yeah, this wouldn't have happened without River Keepers kind of helping promote that the river is a safe place to recreate if you respect it.
Are there any plans for River Keepers in the near or distant future, for that matter? Any goals you can talk about?
Yeah, so just always trying to interact more with the community. So looking for more partnerships and more outreach opportunities. Just trying to get people to actually use and appreciate the river more than they used to.
Yeah. Have you or River Keepers been recognized for the work y'all do in the FM area?
We have. The North Dakota Forest Service has given us a couple of awards for the Reforest the Red. Last year, I was nominated in the arts and culture for the YWCA's Women of the Year and won in that category, so that was fun.
Congratulations.
The Red River Basin Commission has given us some, and Fargo Park District. One year, we received the Morehard Award from the City of Moorhead for our partnerships with them, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do thank you for what you do. If anyone's interested in learning more, are wanting to get involved, where can they go? Who can they contact?
Yeah, so our Facebook page is very active, and then our website is riverkeepers.org, and we also have Instagram.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was fun.
That's Prairie Public's CEO John Harris from Prairie Pulse in a conversation with River Keepers Executive Director Christine Holland on caring for the Red River and connecting communities to it. Prairie Pulse airs Thursdays at 8 p.m. Central on the television service of Prairie Public.
The Empire Theater Company in Grand Forks presents The Rainbow Fish, the musical. Based on the book by Marcus Pfister, the play tells the story of a fish who learns that kindness and sharing are more important than beauty. Performances run April 23rd through May 3rd at the Empire Art Center. Details at empireartcenter.com.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, stay tuned. All Things Considered is next. Since the war in Iran began, millions of Iranians have been without internet access for more than 50 consecutive days. Experts say the blackout is tied to security concerns following the death of Iran's former supreme leader, amid fears signals intelligence could expose sensitive locations. What daily life looks like without internet in Iran and how people are adapting. That's ahead on All Things Considered following Main Street. At 8 p.m. Central tonight, it's The Hidden Brain. Michael Inslicht once went on an unexpectedly grueling hike. It was miserable in the moment, but meaningful in memory. Why we push ourselves to do hard things and what we get from it tonight on Hidden Brain. And that follows Main Street at 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain here on Prairie Public. And in baseball, the Minnesota Twins are searching for answers after a rough weekend in St. Petersburg. They were swept by the Tampa Bay Rays, falling 4-2 Sunday, and extended their losing skid to 5 straight games and 9 of their last 10. The Twins struggled to capitalize offensively, leaving runners on base and hitting just 100 with runners in scoring position during the series. Now 12-16, they head into a 7-game homestand, looking to reset, regroup, and find a spark.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 27th. On this date, in 1952, the public was invited to a tree planting ceremony on the state capitol grounds at Bismarck. The Washington, D.C. Evening Star reported that North Dakotans were dedicating a tree by the Senate entrance to mark the 50th anniversary of the National Reclamation Law sponsored by Senator Henry Hansbrough. Members of the North Dakota Congressional Delegation and their staff participated in the ceremony. Hansbrough was a key co-author and proponent of the National Reclamation Act of 1902, which set aside money from the sale of public lands in 16 arid western states, including North Dakota, to fund irrigation projects, dams, and canals. He believed the federal investment would relieve water scarcity in the West and foster economic growth for small-scale farming versus large-scale opulent landowners. The act led to massive projects, such as those that transformed over 40,000 acres of North Dakota prairie into farmland. The idea had previously been advanced by Theodore Roosevelt, a prodigious sports hunter and wealthy landowner in Dakota Territory, who became known as the Conservation President. Ironically, water retention projects destroyed key river corridor ecosystems, wildlife habitat, and indigenous gardening and cultural sites. During his presidency, Roosevelt established around 230 million acres of public lands between 1901 and 1909, including 150 national forests, the first 55 federal bird reservation and game preserves, 5 national parks, and the first 18 national monuments. In 1905, Roosevelt created the U.S. Forest Service with Gifford Pinchot as its first chief forester. Pinchot's acute eye for habitat helped add forests and wilderness areas. As an avid ornithologist, Roosevelt began an ongoing experiment to carve out habitat for wildlife by creating what would become the National Wildlife Refuge System on March 14, 1903. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lee Serdrick. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota, working with ND Dementia Care Services to offer programs like the Empowered Caregiver Series. Learn more at alz.org/MNND/education-programs.
And that wraps up this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, former HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius joins a bipartisan effort to confront what she calls a moral failing in rural health care. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.